After a pause, the theater darkened again, and high, falsetto-like bassoon notes floated out of the orchestra. Strands of melody intertwined like vegetation bursting out of the earth. A sacred terror in the noonday sun, Stravinsky called it. The increasing density and dissonance of the music caused mutterings, titters, whistles, and shouts. Then, at the beginning of the second section, a dance for adolescents titled The Augurs of Spring, a quadruple shock arrived in the form of harmony, rhythm, image, and movement.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, New Yorker music critic Alex Ross reads from The Rest is Noise. His first book tracks the history of the 20th century through its classical music. Ross says his book is an assault against the argument that classical music is dying or dead. He says, and this is a quote, "Classical music did not glide to a halt sometime around 1900. It was beginning again in a new key, or a lack of key." This reading and discussion of The Rest is Noise with accompanying music took place in November of 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
To get to the book, I have been working on this for a long time, and going all the way back to, I think, when I was in college, I was unnaturally obsessed by the 20th century and by 20th century music, and I had a show in college called Music Since 1900, the title stolen from the great music encyclopedist Nicholas Slonimsky, whom I had the honor of interviewing on the radio at that time, and he told me a wonderful story that tells you something in miniature about the relationship of music and history in the 20th century. In 1917, Slonimsky was already well into his 90s, I believe, when I talked to him on the phone. He lived past 100. So in 1917, he was practicing the piano and someone came in to the house and said, "There's a revolution happening outside." This is St. Petersburg. And so he went outside and walked around looking for the revolution, and he couldn't find it. So he went back to practicing the piano. So that was the one musical perspective on, you know, a great cataclysm in 20th century history, as Andras was saying. Anyway, I did the show, and I was already absorbing everything I could read and listening to everything I could find related to the 20th century. And I don't know if I started consciously thinking about a book at that time, but I was sort of gathering material. And eventually, by the very end of the 20th century, I did start working on the book and finished it earlier this year. So it was a long time in the making. And people ask me, why 20th century music? Why 20th century classical music in particular, when there's so much beautiful classical music that came before, and there's a general perception out there that not all of the sounds that were perpetrated by composers in the 20th century were quite as beautiful as those that came before. And, of course, we had this marvelous century of popular music, which has dominated so many people's attention, and a general sense that classical music has sort of dwindled, sort of wandered off to the margins of society. People talk about it dying. Some people have said that it's already dead. In fact, they've been saying that it's dead for several decades, and yet somehow it's still alive in some kind of zombie state, I suppose. The classical music undead, and a sense that it's lost its relevance to society, to life as it's lived now by ordinary people. And I think the whole idea behind this book was to disprove that notion, to assault it from every angle possible, and to show that no, classical music did not glide to a halt sometime around 1900. It was beginning again in a new key or a lack of key. And it began all over again numerous times as the century went on, as composers were constantly reinventing the language of music or reaching back to older languages or reaching out to popular music. And that's also a major theme in the book, the closeness, despite this perception of classical music as an elite, sort of separatist art form, sort of off in its ivory tower. No, in fact, a lot of composers were listening very closely to popular musicians, and vice versa. Popular music was reacting to the classical ideas. So those are some of the themes of the book, and there is also this idea of examining the confrontation of composers with history itself, with these massive transformations and sometimes terrifying events that took place from 1900 to 2000. And simply by following the careers of the composers, you find yourself in some extraordinary situations. Right at the beginning of the century, Richard Strauss and Kaiser Wilhelm, or Gustav Mahler and the emperor in Vienna, on through the 1920s and 1930s, and particularly in the central chapters of my book, I'm following the careers of composers such as Shostakovich, who had this strange relationship with the Soviet system and with Stalin in particular, where one day he would be exalted as a hero of Soviet music and the next day he would be denounced. You also have Richard Strauss and his dismaying involvement in the cultural apparatus of the Nazi regime, shaking hands with Hitler at an intermission at the Bayreuth Festival, and sort of painting himself into a very dark corner as the 1930s turned into the 1940s. You had American composers in the New Deal period, such as Aaron Copland, expressing the ideals of the New Deal and more radically of the Popular Front, the far left political cadres of American life at that time, and then suffering the consequences, Copland being called before McCarthy's Senator McCarthy's committee in the 1950s. And on and on. You have Stravinsky at dinner with the Kennedys at the White House. I'll pause to retail another favorite anecdote. Stravinsky showed up at the White House and was having a good time. He had a little too much to drink, in fact, and he started bothering the president about his taxes and asking whether possibly why did he have to pay so much tax? He was a great composer, and couldn't there be some arrangement, special arrangement for him? And he was sort of pulled away from the president at that point. And, you know, eventually everything went fine. And as he got back into the car to go home, he turned to his wife and said, "Nice kids," which is just, you know, how celestially hip was Stravinsky to meet John and Jackie Kennedy and call them nice kids. And, you know, the book ends with John Adams's opera Nixon in China. So this is perhaps the major theme of the book, the confrontation of music with history, and in a way using music to listen to history itself, to experience the 20th century through composers' eyes, a somewhat oblique, somewhat eccentric viewpoint on this extraordinary epoch, but I think one that is quite valuable and revealing. At this point, I will turn to the book itself, because it's better than me talking, relatively speaking. And I'll read aloud a couple samples just to give you a flavor of how it goes. May 29th, 1913, was an unusually hot day for Paris in the spring. The temperature reached 85 degrees. By late afternoon, a crowd had gathered in front of the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées on the Avenue Montaigne, where Serge Diaghilev's Ballet Russe was holding its spring gala. Jean Cocteau, who was then 23, recalled, "There for the expert eye were all the makings of a scandal, a fashionable audience in décolletage, outfitted in pearls, egret headdresses, plumes of ostrich, and side by side with the tails and feathers, the jackets, headbands, and showy rags of that race of aesthetes who randomly acclaim the new in order to express their hatred of the loge, a thousand nuances of snobbery, super snobbery, counter snobbery." The better-heeled part of the crowd had grown wary of Diaghilev's methods. Disquieting rumors were circulating about the new musical work in the program, The Rite of Spring, by the young Russian composer Igor Stravinsky, and also about the matching choreography by Nijinsky. Diaghilev, in a press release, promised a new thrill that will doubtless inspire heated discussion. He did not lie. The program began innocuously with a revival of the Ballet Russe's Chopin fantasy, Les Sylphides. After a pause, the theater darkened again, and high, falsetto-like bassoon notes floated out of the orchestra. Strands of melody intertwined like vegetation bursting out of the earth, a sacred terror in the noonday sun, Stravinsky called it, in a description that had been published that morning. the audience listened to the opening section of the rite in relative silence, although the increasing density and dissonance of the music caused mutterings, titters, whistles, and shouts. Then, at the beginning of the second section, a dance for adolescents titled The Augurs of Spring, a quadruple shock arrived in the form of harmony, rhythm, image, and movement. At the outset of the section, the strings and horns play a crunching discord consisting of an F-flat major triad and an E-flat dominant seventh superimposed. These chords clash at every node. A steady pulse propels the chord, but accents land every which way on and off the beat. Even Diaghilev quivered a little when he first heard this music. "Will it last a very long time this way?" he asked. Stravinsky replied, "Till the end, my dear." The chord repeats some 200 times. Meanwhile, Nijinsky's choreography discards classical gestures in favor of near anarchy. As the ballet historian Lynn Garofalo recounts, the dancers trembled, shook, shivered, stamped, jumped crudely and ferociously, circled the stage in wild choravodes. Behind the dancers were pagan landscapes painted by Nicholas Roerich, hills and trees of weirdly bright color, shapes from a dream. Howls of discontent went up from the boxes where the wealthiest onlookers sat. Immediately, the aesthetes in the balconies in the standing room howled back. There were overtones of class warfare in the proceedings. The combative composer Florent Schmitt was heard to yell either, pardon my language, "Shut up, bitches of the 16th, or "Down with the whores of the 16th. The accounts differ. This is a provocation of the Grande Dame of the 16th arrondissement. The literary hostess Jean Mühlfeld, not to be outmaneuvered, exploded into contemptuous laughter. Little more of the score was heard after that. Gertrude Stein, who was there with Carl van Vechten, recalled, "One literally could not, throughout the whole performance, hear the sound of music. Our attention was constantly distracted by a man in the box next to us, flourishing his cane, and finally, in a violent altercation with an enthusiast in the box next to him, his cane came down and smashed the opera hat the other had just put on in defiance. It was all incredibly fierce." So this, of course, was one of the great upheavals in early 20th century music history, and there were many others. There were the premieres of Arnold Schoenberg's first atonal pieces, works in which he simply rejected, threw away the chords, the familiar, sweet, basic chords of Western tradition, and invented new chords, often shockingly dissonant ones. And this music caused even more serious riots with audiences in Vienna, to the point where one performance in 1913, just before the more famous Rite of Spring riot, had to be stopped in the middle. The police were called, and there was a lawsuit that went on in the Viennese courts for some time afterward, caused by another altercation between an enthusiast and a detractor of Schoenberg's music. But it wasn't only about dissonance and musical uproar. There are many other experiments, especially going into the decade of the 1920s. Composers, including the slightly older Stravinsky, reached back to the pre-Romantic past, to Baroque music, even to Renaissance music, and by reinventing, reconfiguring that music, they found a new modern, an alternative modernist vocabulary. There were others who were listening to jazz, Darius Milhaud and the other composers, the sassy little band called Les Six, who incorporated jazz harmony and jazz rhythm into their pieces. And there were others who went even further in the direction of the avant-garde, such as Edgar Varèse and the very lonely but brilliant Charles Ives in America, who experimented with extraordinarily thick conglomerations of independently moving sounds evoking in certain pieces all of the frenzy of the modern city. And on, it was a fantastic period of experiment. And of course, there were other composers who continued writing in an ostensibly more traditional manner, Elgar, Rachmaninoff, and Jean Sibelius, who gets an entire chapter to himself in this book. He's often left out of 20th century music history altogether, so as a kind of blow for the Finns, I've put him back into the thick of things in this book, and standing in for many, many others who could have received and who deserve that kind of deluxe treatment. Then in the middle of the book, politics really comes to the fore. The New Deal in America, the communist regime, and particularly the rise of Stalinism in the Soviet Union, and the advent of Hitler in Germany, all these events change the way composers write in all kinds of unpredictable ways. And there are careers that were stopped. There were those who died in the concentration camps, or met some kind of early end because of the war and all of the chaos surrounding it. There were those who had to leave Europe and come to America. Schoenberg, among many others, Schoenberg and Stravinsky ended up in the Los Angeles area by the end of the 1930s and early 1940s. And the music itself very often became simpler. There was a sort of simplification that happened, sometimes willingly, voluntarily, as in the case of the American composers, sometimes not so voluntarily in the case of the Soviets. Well, the next extract I'd like to read is from the chapter about music in the Soviet Union, and I'm going to describe what may be, for me at least, the most spectacular collision of music and the main stream of 20th century history in the whole book. And this involves Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony. Even in the grip of totalitarian terror, life goes on. People are able to feel joy, rage, sorrow, love. Music is in fact better at communicating these primal emotions than it is at managing anything as tricky as irony. Irony in the standard definition is saying something other than what one appears to be saying. To talk about musical irony, we first have to agree on what the music appears to be saying, and then we have to agree on what music is really saying. This is invariably difficult to do. We can, however, learn to be wary of any interpretation that displays too much certitude about what the music is really saying, and stay alert to multiple levels of meaning. Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony becomes a rich experience when heard in this way. So does his Seventh Symphony, or Leningrad, which for many years was dismissed as an exercise in wartime propaganda. Shostakovich displayed patriotic fervor from the start of the war. In late June 1941, immediately after the Nazi invasion began, he reported to the Civil Defense Headquarters in Leningrad with his pupil Benjamin Fleischmann and volunteered for duty. Rejected on account of his poor eyesight, he joined the Leningrad Conservatory Fire Brigade and moved into a barracks in the building. A famous photo shows him wearing a fireman's helmet on the conservatory roof. The image was staged for propaganda purposes. Colleagues made sure to keep the prize of Soviet music out of harm's way. In July, Shostakovich set to work on the Seventh Symphony, in which he planned to record, in almost stenographic fashion, the emotions of battle. In mid-September, he announced on Leningrad radio that he had finished the first two movements. He said, "Our art is threatened with great danger. We will defend our music." German artillery shells were by then landing in the city, marking the onset of the 900-day siege of Leningrad. For several composer friends, Shostakovich played through at the piano what he had written so far and continued playing even as the air raid sirens went off and anti-aircraft fire all but drowned him out. Against his own wishes, he was evacuated from the city on October 1st and spent the winter in Kubyshev, formerly Samara in the Volga region. The Leningrad had its premiere there in March 1942. It then made its way around the world, its progress complicated by wartime. As The New Yorker reported in a Talk of the Town item, the score was transferred to microfilm, put in a tin can, flown to Tehran, driven by car to Cairo, flown to South America, and finally flown to New York. Toscanini beat out Koussevitzky and Stokowski for the rights to conduct the Western premiere, which took place on July 19, 1942. Time magazine put Shostakovich on the cover in his firefighting regalia with the caption, "Amid bombs bursting in Leningrad, he heard the chords of victory." The composer became a propaganda symbol for the Allied cause, a profile in courage. Besieged Leningrad heard the symphony on August 9, 1942, under the most dramatic circumstances imaginable. The score was flown in by military aircraft in June, and a severely depleted Leningrad radio orchestra began learning it. After a mere 15 musicians showed up for the initial rehearsal, the commanding general ordered all competent musicians to report from the front lines. The players would break from the rehearsals to return to their duties, which sometimes included the digging of mass graves for the victims of the siege. Three members of the orchestra died of starvation before the premiere took place. The opposing German general heard about the performance in advance and planned to disrupt it. But the Soviets preempted him by launching a bombardment of German positions, Operation Squall, it was called. An array of loudspeakers then broadcast the Leningrad into the silence of no man's land. Never in history had a musical composition entered the thick of battle in quite this way. The symphony became a tactical strike against German morale. There's one other story, which I decided not to put in the book because it couldn't quite be verified, but I did read an account of some former German soldiers who returned, who came to Leningrad many years after the end of the war and were talking to their former enemies and recalled hearing Shostakovich's music coming at them and said when they heard it, they knew that Germany was never going to win the war. Now, I mentioned that an important part of this book is telling the stories not only of those who made great technical breakthroughs and shook up the language of music and created thrilling and or alarming sounds, and this is an exciting story that's all in the book, but also to pay proper attention to those who did not, on the surface of music, revolutionize everything and reject the past, but who are nonetheless deeply original and important composers. And one major intention of this book was to sort of put everyone on the same level and to synthesize two repertories that are often completely unrelated to each other. The repertoire of music that is analyzed in scholarly circles and prized in new music circles, and then there's this whole alternative canon of music which is actually played often on orchestra programs and appears in opera houses. Composers such as Sibelius and Vaughan Williams and Copland, Shostakovich, and Benjamin Britten. And I'm going to read the beginning of my chapter on Benjamin Britten, if I can find it. Aldeburgh is a windswept fishing town on the east coast of the British Isles. The novelist E.M. Forster called it a bleak little place, not beautiful. It huddles around a flint tower church and sprawls down to the North Sea, and what a wallop the sea makes as it pounds at the shingle. Nearby is a quay at the end of an estuary, and here the scenery becomes melancholy and flat. Expanses of mud, saltish commons, the marsh birds crying. Some decades later, the great German writer W.G. Sebald fell even more deeply in love with the oblique charms of Aldeburgh and neighboring villages and devoted his book The Rings of Saturn to the geography and history of the region. "I had not a single thought in my head," Sebald wrote, describing one of his walks across the flats. "With each step that I took, the emptiness within and the emptiness without grew ever greater and the silence more profound. I imagined myself amidst the remains of our own civilization after its extinction in some future catastrophe." There are ruins all around Aldeburgh. At Dunwich, a few miles up the coast, an entire medieval town has slid into the sea. Around Orford to the south, the landscape is dotted with relics of two world wars and the Cold War that followed. Gun emplacements designed to impede a Nazi invasion that never came. Radar masts employing the technology invented by researchers in nearby Bodsey Manor. Atomic weapons establishment facilities looking like skeletons of palaces. When the weather changes, these wide-open vistas of sea and sky, with their stone and metal memories of the past, can have a somewhat terrifying effect. A mass of black cloud rears up behind a sunlit scene. The sea turns a dull, menacing green. An abandoned house groans in the wind. Then, in the next second, the light changes. The water assumes an iridescent color, as if lit from within. Anonymous jewels sparkle on the beach. The sun appears under the ceiling of cloud and floods the world. In the Alderboro churchyard lies Benjamin Britten. He was born 30 miles up the coast in Lowestoft in 1913. His childhood home looked out over the beach to the North Sea, or the German Ocean, as it was called before the First World War. Britten lived for most of his life in the Alderboro area, and he once stated that all his music came from there. "I believe in roots, in associations, in backgrounds, in personal relationships," he said in a speech in 1964. "I want my music to be of use to people, to please them. I do not write for posterity." Britten's opera Peter Grimes, a work of staggering dramatic force, is soaked in Aldeburgh to its bones. First heard in June 1945, 1 month after the end of the European War, it tells of a fisherman who causes the death of his apprentices and loses his mind from guilt. The story comes from the poet George Crabbe, who grew up in Aldeburgh in the later 18th century and apparently based the character of Grimes on a real-life case. Crabbe describes the estuaries thus. "The dark, warm flood ran silently and slow. There anchoring, Peter chose from man to hide, there hang his head and view the lazy tide in its hot, slimy channel slowly glide. Here, dull and hopeless, he'd lie down and trace how sidelong crabs had scrawled their crooked race, or sadly listen to the tuneless cry of fishing gull or clanging golden eye." The first orchestral interlude in Britten's opera brings the coast to life. High grace notes mimic the cries of birds. Rainbow-like arpeggios imitate the play of light on the water. Booming brass chords approximate the thudding of the waves. It is rich, expansive music, recalling Debussy's La Mer and Mahler's more pantheistic moods. Yet it hardly ravishes the senses. The orchestration is spare, the melodic figures are sharply turned, the plain harmonies flecked with dissonance. The music is poised perfectly between the familiar and the strange, the pictorial and the psychological. Britten made his inner landscape as vivid as the rumble of the sea, the cries of the gulls, and the scuttling of the crabs. For my final excerpt from the book, I'll skip ahead to a very different world, the 1960s, and this gives you a sense of this last major theme that I pursue throughout the book, the interaction of the classical and the popular. One night in 1967, the Hungarian avant-garde composer Zsuzs Ligeti was sitting with several colleagues at the Darmstadt Schlosskeller, the favorite late-night hangout of teachers and students at the very avant-garde summer courses for new music in Darmstadt, when Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, a new album by the Beatles, started playing over the loudspeakers. Some of the sounds on the record bore a surprising resemblance to the Darmstadter's latest and most advanced experiments. The song A Day in the Life included two spells of ad libitum playing, the second of them leading into a gorgeously strange E major chord played by three pianos and a harmonium. Players were given a score indicating what register they should have reached in any given bar. The last chord was executed in the fashion of musique concrète, the attack cut off and the decay amplified over a long duration. The Beatles had first dipped into the Darmstadt sound in March of the previous year while working on the album Revolver. Paul McCartney had been checking out Stockhausen's Gesang der Jünglinge, with its electronic layering of voices, and Kontakt by the same composer with its swirling tape loop patterns. At his request, engineers at Abbey Road Studios inserted similar effects into the song Tomorrow Never Knows. By way of thanks, the Beatles put Stockhausen's face on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The following year, for the White Album, John Lennon and Yoko Ono created the tape collage Revolution 9, where, for a split second, the final chords of Sibelius' Seventh Symphony can be heard. Adventurous rock bands on the West Coast also paid heed to the classical avant-garde. Members of both the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane attended Stockhausen's lectures in Los Angeles in 1966 and 1967, while the maverick rock star Frank Zappa spoke of his teenage love for the music of Edgar Varèse, whom he once looked up in the phone book and called out of the blue. It's true. Even the most jaded veteran of 20th century musical upheaval must have been startled to find that the post-war avant-garde was now serving as mood music for the psychedelic generation. The wall separating classical music from neighboring genres appeared ready to crumble, as it had momentarily in the 20s and 30s, when Copland, Gershwin, and Duke Ellington crossed paths at Carnegie Hall. Classical record labels made amusing attempts to capitalize on the phenomenon by marketing abstruse modern repertory to kids tripping out on LSD. An LP of Bengt Hambraeus's Constellations 2 and Interferences on the Limelight label carried this text on the jacket: "Listening to Bengt Hambraeus's fantastic sound, its magnificent electronic and organized electronic total sound experience should involve you as much as any music you are capable of loving, be it the sound of the Beatles, Bach, Beethoven, Boulez, Beach Boys, or Belafonte, Barbra Streisand, Pearl Bailey, Blue Cheer, or whatever. Hambraeus is really tuned in, smashing." Smashing! Even as Stockhausen and Ligeti brushed against the counterculture, several younger Americans, Terry Riley, Steve Reich, and Philip Glass, made a different kind of breakthrough. They simplified their harmonic language and rediscovered the pleasure of a steady pulse, devising a modern tonality that had nothing nostalgic about it. What Kurt Weill said in the 1920s held true again. Once musicians obtained everything they'd imagined in their most daring dreams, they started again from scratch. Riley, Reich, and Glass came to be called minimalists, although they are better understood as the continuation of a circuitous, difficult-to-name development in American music that dated back to the early years of the century and, more often than not, took root on the West Coast. One composer after another set aside a premise that had governed classical composition for centuries: the conception of a musical work as a self-contained linguistic activity that develops relationships among discrete thematic characters over a well-marked period of time. This music was, by contrast, open-ended, potentially limitless. It was a purely American art, free of modernist angst and inflected with pop optimism. Steve Reich said, "Schoenberg gives a very honest musical portrayal of his times. I salute him, but I don't want to write like him. Stockhausen, Berio, and Boulez were portraying in very honest terms what it was like to pick up the pieces of a bombed-out continent after World War II, but for some American in 1948 or 1958 or 1968, in the real context of Tail Fins, Chuck Berry, and millions of burgers sold, to pretend that instead we're really going to have the dark brown angst of Vienna is a lie, a musical lie." Reich and his colleagues borrowed from popular music, especially from bebop and modern jazz, and they affected pop music in turn. The Velvet Underground adopted Lamont Young's drone aesthetic. Art rockers such as David Bowie and Brian Eno showed up at Reich and Glass's shows. minimalist influence radiated outward in the 80s and 90s, to the point where you could walk into any hip boutique or hotel lounge and sooner or later hear some distant, burbling cousin of Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. Brian Eno once summarized minimalism as a drift away from narrative and towards landscape, from performed event to sonic space. Riley, Reich, and Glass spent their formative years in the urban wilds of New York and San Francisco, but their works have spiritual links to the capacious West. Unlike Aaron Copland's sepia-toned prairie, minimalist vistas are filtered through new ways of seeing and hearing that relate to the technology of speed. They evoke the experience of driving in a car across empty desert, the layered repetitions in the music mirroring the changes that the eye perceives. Road signs flashing by, a mountain range shifting on the horizon, a pedal point of asphalt underneath. That's another Steve Reich piece called Drumming. And that's sort of more or less all I have in terms of my solo spiel about the book. So if people have questions at this point, I'd be very happy to entertain them. Did everyone more or less hear that? He's asking about something which really became quite pronounced in the post-war era after World War II, when people became very concerned with defining high and low art and the notion that some forms of a lot of popular music was under attack for degrading culture, and classical music was sort of raised up as the epitome of high culture, and there was a sort of canyon opening up between the two. And then he was saying that that in more recent years, a lot of these categories have broken down or been abandoned by a lot of people. And do I consider some rock music or other kinds of pop music art, or do I believe that those distinctions should be maintained? I'll tell my sort of personal story of how I discovered popular music. As I was growing up, I listened exclusively to classical music, sort of all the way through most of my teenage years. Believe it or not, this made me a very popular kid at St. Albans. I started with Mozart and ended with Brahms, basically. And this was all I cared about. And this is incredibly varied and rich and emotionally fulfilling music. And it sort of satisfied all of my basic needs in terms of what I wanted from music at the time. I had a wonderful piano teacher who's now passed away, a D.C. area pianist and composer named Denning Barnes, who one day set Schoenberg's three pieces for piano in front of me, and it was very scary, and I didn't know what was happening. We were floating away into this other realm, and there was also the Berg piano sonata, which he had me play, which I'm sure some of you know. There it is. Music that seems to float away from tonality and then comes back. Sort of it was a door opening to this new harmonic world for me. So I started marching OK Albon. I started marching through the 20th century decade by decade, and when I was at college, I really got into the avant-garde post-war repertory, seething soundscapes of Xenakis and Ligeti and Stockhausen and so on. And then some DJs at my radio station, a college radio station, pointed out that a guy from the jazz department said, this music sounds a lot like Cecil Taylor and Ornette Coleman, free jazz. And I checked out those records and was amazed to find that so-called popular musicians could be very dissonant and dense and create music that most people would find unlistenable and therefore, in my mind, were marked out as serious people. And and so I admitted, to my own surprise, these popular musicians to my canon of serious music. And the same thing happened when the rock DJs gave me records by Sonic Youth and Pere Ubu. Those were the first rock records I ever owned. And lo and behold, here were vulgar rock musicians making these strange dissonant sounds, and they too must be serious. So that was the measuring stick that I used. If it was dissonant, it was serious, which now I don't take that quite so seriously, but it was very important at the time. And you know, suddenly I was actually listening to rock music and popular music. And yeah, I do think that music is art, not simply because it's dissonant. You know, I mean, how do you define what's art and what's merely entertainment? I mean, there's sort of obvious extremes, you know, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis on the one hand and, you know, Britney Spears' latest attempted comeback on the other. And, you know, there is some kind of line that you can draw or some kind of distinction you can make here. But, you know, there's all this stuff in the middle, which you're not sure, you know, what category it belongs in. And something else I love to talk about is, you know, music being written right now. Now, where the popular music can be mistaken for the classical music and the classical music for the pop. For example, this is a music, this is something by a contemporary Icelandic composer. That's Björk. She's in fact basically known as a pop singer, but is incredibly inventive in how she uses sound and texture and harmony and everything. And then on the other hand, you have someone like Osvaldo Galeoff, a quote-unquote classical composer who's writing music like this. That's the noted Mozart soprano Dawn Upshaw adopting a quite different manner of singing for Osvaldo Galeoff's Aire, A-Y-R-E, a really remarkable record, which is a song cycle, the idea being to unify all the sounds, all the traditions that used to exist next to one another in Moorish Spain. So anyway, the point being that that composers and pop musicians are sort of overlapping and intermingling right now in various interesting ways. And, you know, to put something in a category, is it art, is it entertainment, is it classical, is it popular, is often not the most interesting question to ask for me. And I first want to get to know the individual, and does the individual artist have something compelling to say to me and perhaps to other people whom I can reach through my writing, and then defining it and categorizing it somehow comes later.
Is there anybody that you regret not having talked about in this large undertaking?
Oh no, there's a very long list of composers that that I talked about much less than I would have liked to, or hardly at all. I mean, when I wrote about Sibelius, toward the beginning of the chapter on Sibelius, I say this chapter stands in for a lot of other composers, such as Elgar and Rachmaninoff and Vaughan Williams and Carl Nielsen, who's a composer I really, really love and hardly say anything about in the book, composers who sort of weren't in the vanguard or can't be identified with one ism or another and are just hard to include in in a sort of a sweeping history such as this, because they are loners, and yet they are such important composers. And I can't include everyone. I did include everyone at one point, because the initial draft of the book was twice as long as what we have now, and I had to be very brutal about what I left out. I chose people, I chose individual works, just one or two works that had to stand in for someone's entire career, and I had to choose composers who stood in for others. I just needed to keep the story going. I needed to go from point A to point B, from the year 1900 to the year 2000. And the people I include here, or that I give a lot of space to in this book, I'm not necessarily saying these are the most important. I'm saying, like, these people were, for me, the best way of telling the story, but there are so many others, and I hope if people are just getting to know this music that they will pursue some of these names who appear only in passing here and discover the music of Bohuslav Martinu or Frank Martin, or just there's kind of an infinite list, and on my blog I think there'll be sort of bits and pieces of the book that I cut popping up for years to come. Yeah, Mather.
You referred to the, you know, this topic we hear about the death of classical music, and I began wondering, with all the ink, with all the words that have been written on this, including your own book, whether this might not be kind of good for classical music in a way. It's kind of bringing the topic, you know, back onto the cultural radar at least. So that's just my observation. My question is, in 1978, so almost 30 years ago, I heard the pianist Charles Rosen make the observation or prediction that one day, maybe a century from then, we would look back and see the stylistic differences between Schoenberg and Stravinsky as being no greater than those between Mozart and Haydn.
I think in this book, it's not so much sort of trying to move everything closer together and try to get over the stylistic differences, which are really interesting. And you know, to get to know the music, you have to know the particulars of how it works and the very different things that the composers are trying to achieve. But I guess what interests me is how, just by a sort of few degrees of separation, you can go from a composer who seems to be at one extreme to another in a totally different world. And a lot of the book is telling these stories of surprising connections. I start the book with the story of when George Gershwin met Alban Berg, which is a wonderful story, which I won't tell there because it's right in the book. Ellington's kind of funny relationship with Gershwin, or you know, Milton Babbitt being the teacher of Stephen Sondheim, or, you know, this whole story of minimalist music, this you know, 1960s sound which came along, which had so much to do with jazz and early rock and roll in terms of its feel and energy and timbre and so forth. You know, that actually, there's sort of a circuitous line of development which goes back to Schoenberg in a really surprising way, because Schoenberg was in California and he taught people like Cage, John Cage, and Lou Harrison, who laid out some of the early groundwork for the minimalist style, applying Schoenberg's lessons in very different ways, and in ways that Schoenberg couldn't have predicted or perhaps approved of. And then Lamont Young, the sort of proto-minimalist who got the whole thing going in the late 1950s, was fascinated by Webern's music, by the most refined and esoteric 12-tone writing. But what he did is he decided to draw out the tones and a piece, sort of some material that in the hands of Webern would have lasted only a minute or two, you know, is drawn out to an hour, because he turns those flecks of tone into drones, into these immense lingering tones. And, you know, then you start entering into this kind of West Coast, somewhat psychedelic atmosphere which flows into minimalism. But, you know, it comes from 12-tone music, from a West Coast guy's very unexpected perception of 12-tone music. So that, you know, that's the kind of relationship that I'm interested in. And, you know, you can't erase the differences, but you can just sort of notice how composers talk to each other in interesting ways, or composers and popular musicians. And, I don't know whether it's, I hope, actually, that we don't lose the marvelous sense of variety that 20th century offers us. But I think as listeners, we can be more eclectic and not have to sort of side with one camp or another, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. And how do you handle this in this very fast-paced society? I mean, how do you go about the hearing or
That's a very good point. I mean, it doesn't go very well in the background if you sort of, you know, play Varese in your local supermarket. People's shopping patterns might be disrupted, or there might be no shoppers at all. And it does demand. I mean, it demands a certain amount of preparation and attention. Though, I mean, all music, you know, should be given that kind of attention. I mean, I think one problem that classical music has right now is its kind of harmless ubiquity in our culture, and the fact that it is playing in dentists' offices and doctors' waiting rooms and in bus stations and train stations. You know, there's this policy now. A bunch of police departments around the country and sort of managers of public spaces have found that if you pipe in Mozart into the bus station, then they found that delinquents and homeless people will go away. And so it's being used as this kind of awful cleansing, social cleansing device. And that's a really discouraging development, because it creates the impression that this is kind of antiseptic music and background music and just something that sort of chatters away there in the background. And, you know, what Mozart is dealing with in Don Giovanni or the symphony in G minor is the, you know, very dire crucial states of emotion, and it shouldn't be treated as background in that way. So you know, the 20th century, yeah, but then there are other parts of it which, you know, there's music in the 20th century which is very sheerly beautiful, and, you know, it's sort of too often pictured generally as the century of dissonance. I mean, Arvo Pärt's music, all this minimalist repertory, you know, you sort of can play in your car or you're driving from one place to another, and it can sort of recede someone to the background or sort of act on your unconscious in some interesting way, and that was Steve Reich playing as you were coming in before I started talking. So, however you categorize this music, it's, you know, its opposite is also there in the repertory. But it does need some explaining, and I think people find when they put on one of these pieces in a concert hall, if someone gets up and just says, you know, a few words about what was going on in the composer's world when he or she wrote the piece and what was what they were trying to achieve, then people's listening kind of orientation can be changed for the better. And it's that kind of context and background for this music was really needed, and that's certainly what I've tried to do in this book.
I agree that explaining things about a lot of new pieces helps, and I'm speaking as a musician. But also, I have a question as a musician. The problem is not just audiences, but I find that most classical musicians don't want to play new music. So you can't say, well, they don't know anything about music, or they don't know the music, because obviously they know about music, and even musicians who have played a lot of this music, a lot of the time they don't enjoy it. I mean, it's a minority of musicians who really are dedicated to playing what's being written in their time. So how do you reconcile that with, you know?
No, that's tough. I mean, and, you know, a lot of the music is extremely difficult and makes exceptional demands on the players. And people, you know, composers give a pianist a 7-minute piece, you know, which has been commissioned, which requires, you know, may require a month or more to learn, and then they play it once, and then the question is, you know, when is this, you know, if it sort of doesn't, you know, get much of a reaction from the audience, is it ever going to be played again? And, you know, is it worth the effort? And so a lot of musicians make that calculation and decide not to pursue it. But I've also been told that the sort of the 20th century repertory and contemporary music is becoming increasingly easy for especially sort of the youngest musicians coming out of conservatory now. Somehow it just falls under their fingers without so much trouble. And, you know, composers tell me that they're amazed at how quickly the youngest musicians can pick it up, which is not some kind of ageist comment. I just think that that the teaching syllabus in conservatories has changed, and there is more 20th century music, which is, you know, part of the basic learning repertory and practice pieces and so on. So it's just more in the air, and there's the repertory is less severely limited to sort of, you know, 18th, 19th centuries. And there is so much 20th century music which is played all the time that musicians don't have trouble with. You know, I don't think people complain about playing Aaron Copland or Shostakovich. But that's real. But that is real. Yeah. Yes, but there are a lot of composers today who are working in that tradition. You know, who, you know, just new music, contemporary music doesn't have to be insanely difficult to be considered, you know, serious and worthy. So I mean, it's a really diverse area right now. If a musician decides like I don't want to play this, you know, something that difficult, why not seek out something less difficult by another composer which speaks a totally different language? And the point is, we need to be playing new music to make the point that classical music isn't dead, that it is a living tradition that extends from the past into the present. Living composers are in conversation with the older ones, and, you know, we wouldn't have any music at all if people hadn't had the attitude in earlier centuries of wanting to play only the new music and to foster composers. So it's a real difficulty that's developed in the 20th century, where we've sort of fallen too much in love with the past. And it actually really started in the late 19th century, when the repertory shifted heavily from the living to the dead. As far as I know, Schoenberg wasn't on drugs or Stravinsky. He's asking about does drug use explain some of the more extreme musical developments in the 20th century? Not in the early part of the 20th century, as far as I know. Once you get into the minimalist period, yes, there was some of that going on out in the West Coast in the 1950s and 1960s, I think. Lamont Young was known to be a very good connection in New York in the 60s if you were after a certain kind of mind-expanding experience. I tell this story in the book that there's some kind of code that was used where six bars of the sonata for oboe meant 6 ounces of whatever it was. So that was the code that was used there in downtown Manhattan. But of course, you know, this was also, this interest in drones and using music to sort of enter into a different kind of state. It had been going on the West Coast from the beginning of the century, and Henry Cowell was became very interested in Indian music and Asian music and all kinds of other non-Western musical traditions, which taught him a whole different way of writing music, of unfolding music in time, and that just happened to, you know, go pretty well with the psychedelic drug period a little later on. But it was kind of a serious intellectual and also spiritual quest that the West Coast composers were on from the beginning of the century. You know, that for those entering this musical world for the first time, the 20th century will serve as a great gateway to classical music at large, as well as this book hopefully being an introduction to the many hundreds of great composers who lived in this period.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.